Thank you, Eckhart, and thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be in this fantastic venue and this great event with all these great colleagues and to interact. So I'm looking forward to spending a few days here, and I regret I could not stay longer. So I will talk to you today about computational work that we have been doing in my group over the last five years, I would say, aimed at developing computational tools for simulating coupled turbulence interactions with mobile beds. And I'll show you recent results showing now the capabilities of these tools and the kind of physical information that we can get from simulating a range of bed forms in a range of systems. Before I proceed further, though, I would like to start by saying that this is the work of a number of people that I've had the pleasure of working with, my students and postdocs. So most of the work I present is by Alijo Sonejat and Kristen Escauriaza, with contributions by Seoku Kang and Xiao Le Yang. And of course, this has been supported by the National Center for Research Dynamics, NSF, and the Minnesota Supercomputing Center. So a bit of an outline of my talk. I'll start with a little bit of a motivation to connect with this program. I will spend a little bit of time telling you about the numerical algorithms we have developed to allow us to simulate flows in natural waterways with coupled morphohydrodynamic type of simulations. This is not a talk that focuses on numerical algorithms, so I'm going to briefly skim onto some of the basic features of the numerical techniques and move forward. And I would like to focus the bulk of my talk on a number of examples demonstrating the capabilities of the computational tools and demonstrating the kind of physical insights that we can get right now. And so I will talk about sound waves in scour halls, our earlier work that was done by Kristen Escauriaza, and in our more recent work, simulating of sound waves in open channels and bed forms in larger systems like streams and rivers. And a little bit in the end, if I have time, I'll tell you a bit of a more recent work at what I call the energy sediment nexus, where we're talking about hydrokinetic devices in rivers and they interact with sediment beds. So there are some issues there that could become quite interesting actually and give a new twist to the problem, a new dimension. And I'll leave you with some parting thoughts. You know, they were, from my point of view, what I think are some of the key challenging issues that remain and so on. So obviously, I don't want to preach to the choir here. I think the purpose of this is fluid-mediated particle transport geophysical flows. And bed forms are at the center of all this, whether we're talking about beds sculpted by water flow or by wind in aerolian transport. We have these spectacular features that emerge across a range of scales. You have here an image of a laboratory scale experiment in a small flume showing sand waves propagating. This is an image of bed forms in a meandering channel that we have at the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory, which we call the Outer Stream Lab. And then going into some bigger scale features, and big scale rivers in the San Francisco Bay and so on. In all this, we have this ubiquitous sort of sediment waves that arise as a result of the mobile sediment with the turbulent flow. They are not only they are spectacular in the beauty and in their complexity, but are also important because they determine the manner in which sediment is transported through rivers. Especially during flooding events, these bed forms are able to propagate, to transport huge amounts of sediments impacting erosion, hydraulic structures that are in the riverbed and so on. But are also important because they create this continuously changing dynamic roughness that changes the flow structures through the river or the waterways. So where we come in here is our kind of overall overarching research focus in my group has been to develop computational tools that enable us to carry out this coupled simulation of turbulence and transport phenomena in natural waterways. So ideally, we would like to be able to simulate such complexity as you see here. If we could scan the bathymetry of this and get a number of the critical details of streams like that or river systems with embedded hydraulic structures, and we know something about the sediments that are in there, you know, to be able to predict both the flow and the sediment transport. And of course, this is a very challenging problem because we are dealing with arbitrarily complex geometries. Okay, these are nature-made geometries. We are dealing with a situation where both the bottom and top boundary of our system are mobile. We have mobile riverbeds, we have free surface effects and so on. And so we would like to develop a computational framework that allow us to take into account all these complexities. And as I mentioned earlier, I'll spend a little bit talking about the numerical methods we've developed. All this is published already, so I don't want to spend any time on this. But in a nutshell, we have developed, in my group, we have developed this immersed boundary method, which we call the curvilinear immersed boundary method. The method was originally developed to simulate flows in cardiovascular anatomies, flows in the heart, or swimming of aquatic animals. So it is able to simulate arbitrarily complex geometries that are moving and so on. And we started with Seo-Ku Kang as his PhD a few years ago to extend this method to simulate actually flows in natural waterways. So the idea is this, we have, this is a riverbed, this is actually a section of the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory outdoor stream lab where the riverbed has been scanned here, the stream bed has been scanned at sub-millimeter resolution and you have individual, you see individual roughness elements and so on, or you have rock structures like that. So if we are able to actually scan this type of complex structures, we would like to incorporate them in the computational method. And the idea is that we can take any complex shape and embed it into a background mesh. So you have a meandering bed which has a complex bathymetry. We can embed it into a background curvilinear mesh that sort of approximates the channel. And in it now we have an interface which is arbitrarily complex. And we have to somehow tell the flow solver that this interface is there. And we do this by using reconstruction techniques where so we have a grid which is structured and we have this arbitrarily complex shape in there, and then we use interpolation methods to reconstruct boundary conditions at points that are in the immediate vicinity of the body. So that's in a nutshell the numerical method. And if you're interested in laminar flows, of course this reconstruction is done using linear or quadratic interpolation. If you're interested in turbulent flows, we have to use a wall model to reconstruct the boundary conditions at immersed boundary nodes. So we have incorporated second order accurate numerics. We have incorporated very powerful iterative solvers that allow us to get efficient simulations on very fine computational grids. We are interested in doing simulations on tens or hundreds of millions of grid nodes. And the method is capable actually to run in a DNS mode, LES, or in a steady runs, depending on what you, yeah.
I was just wondering why you use curvilinear coordinates. But is that just so that you don't have to simulate those big areas where there is no
right,
at all?
Yeah. Right. So I could put this in a rectangular box, but then I'm wasting a lot of resolution. Right. So the idea of the curvilinear grid is to actually allow you, for this type of meandering rivers is perfect, because you can actually get most of the resolution in the right areas. And in it, you, yeah, but that's what it is.
With the time step algorithm, is this just for the pressure, or do you have sort of an implicit scheme for diffusion?
This is an implicit fractional step algorithm, both so you solve an advection step with the pressure from the previous time step and then you correct in the next time step to satisfy continuity equation. Both are solved implicitly in this case. Okay, so and we have the ability to do fluid structure interaction. By the way, fluid structure interaction is important because we want to use this technique to simulate sediment. So this interface now is not going to be fixed anymore. It can evolve dynamically as a result, let's say, of an Exner equation for bed load transport. Okay, and you'll see this later on. And the code is parallelized, allowing us to do this efficient simulation. So we've done a lot of work with this. I just will show you, I have a video here just to give you an idea of the capabilities of the method. This is the outdoor stream lab at the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory that I mentioned here. It's a field scale stream that we built there to be able to do field scale controlled experiments. We scan the bathymetry of this, and so this has been prescribed as input to the numerical model. And you can see here the results of an LES simulation showing actually velocity magnitude contours at the surface at bankful condition. And there is actually very interesting physics in this flow that we've been able to uncover through the simulations, that they are all highlighted in this JGR paper, which was published a couple of years ago. Now, a more recent actually result that shows further the capability of the method is this type of simulation, which this is Eagle Creek, Minnesota, is an actual field scale stream. This is about 1 kilometer long ridge here, and we went out there, we scanned, we actually surveyed the bathymetry in great detail. This is a very complex site. As you can see, there are all kinds of big boulders showing up here. There are even tree logs that were actually randomly placed in different locations. We were interested actually in simulating and in looking at nutrient transport in these types of streams, okay? So it turns out that it is very important to incorporate all this because this create hydraulic conditions here that could trap traces for a very long time in here. And you can have long residence times, as you'll see in a minute. So this is a result of an LES simulation of this, showing an instantaneous snapshot of the flow, of the velocity patterns on the flow. And I will show you now a video that shows transport of a tracer. So we are releasing actually, we are releasing a slug of salt here at the inlet, and you just let it go. And it takes a while. This is actually a simulation that took a while to carry out because it's, the grid is quite fine. It has about 100 million grid nodes. And it took quite a long time, actually, for the tracer to wash out. But one thing I want to point out here is, and you can see this already, and as the time goes by, that there are areas in here where you can trap traces for a very long time. Look at these areas, for instance. And now they're still very active. Tracer is trapped and it's been released with turbulent events at shear layers and so on. And, you know, after even the dye has gone through, all the salt has gone through, still, you have quite active areas where tracer is trapped in here as well, and so on. So that kind of gives you an idea of the capabilities of the method. We have done extensive validation with field measurements and so on. I'm not going to go into that because I really want to get into the sediment transport calculations. But that sort of gives you an idea of the type of modeling capabilities that these tools allow us to, the type of complexity that allow us to handle right now. Okay. Yeah?
How long is long? You know, how many processes?
So this particular simulation on the fine grid, it took a couple of months to run actually. It was a couple of hundred processors, but this has a very fine time step because in order to do the advection, we have run it on a coarser grid. It's you can get on about 30, 40 million grid nodes. You can get this in a matter of a week, and of course, you can. I mean, all this is relative because now we're talking about scaling to petascale and so on. So this is kind of, you know, the tools are ready to take advantage of this. And so, but look at this, at the end of this, there were still traces that were trapped in here and so on. So I mentioned that the code has the capability to do free surface modeling. And this is the work again from the PhD of Seoku Kang. It was published in Advanced Water Resources last year. We have incorporated now in the immersed boundary method a level set capability, and we have a two fluid formulation now. Well, it's a single fluid but with varying properties, so we have air and water, we have implemented this level set capability actually to allow us to simulate free surface flows. Do LES complexity flows with in free surface complex free surface flows with arbitrarily complex immersed boundaries. I'll show you an example of this. So this is an experiment that we did at the St. Anthony Falls Laboratory. It's a straight flume right here. The flow is coming from the top in this orientation. This is a rock structure that it's typically used in stream restoration projects, and that's why we placed it there. This is actually the result of the numerical simulation looking at the surface. This is the zero level set. Essentially visualizing the waves of the free surface. As you can see, you get hydraulic jumps. By the way, the structure is, it's deeper, it's really, it's inclined this way. So this part is close to the free surface, so the fruit number is actually, gets quite high here. And then you have actually much deeper depth here. So that's why you see this complex variation. But you see complex wave systems that are created and so on. It looks quite realistic, and then we had measurements of mean elevation and elevation RMS, and again, this is the level of agreement that you get with this technique. So that kind of, again, now we have the capability of doing these complex flows with free surface. Moving now to the morphodynamic model, and this is a work that has been done by Alijo Sronejad, who started with a code that Seoku Kang developed for his thesis, and that code had rigid bed, and then we wanted to make the bed move and really start looking at morphodynamic calculations. So the idea here is that you have this immersed boundary, this immersed interface here, which before it was stationary, but now this thing can evolve, okay? And by nature of the method, we can actually, because we don't have a grid that actually follows the bed shape, this bed shape can become extremely complex, can be arbitrarily complex, and it can have arbitrarily large amplitudes, actually, involved. So it's a very flexible technique. So, and how does it evolve? We discretize the sediment-water interface with an unstructured mesh, and we solve on it the Exner's equation. Okay, so you have Exner's equation here, the bed load flux. You have the position and entrainment from the bed, and there is quite. I mean, the techniques again I described in great detail in these papers. The bed load flux here now has to be calculated, and this is it depends on the local sediment concentration, which. This is, we have taken just existing, so typical Van Rijn type of methods that are available in the literature. Remember now, these are formulas that are based on mean flow properties, and we are assuming that, because we are doing an LES now, that we are applying them for the instantaneous flow. So that's actually a major limitation, I think, right now, that maybe it puts a sort of, it opens a direction for future extension of this model, because we have, as you see, the ability now to do LES with mobile beds, but it's all driven by this kind of archaic sort of sediment transport correlations, okay? We get reasonable results, as you see, but I think this is clearly an area for improvement right now. We also have an equation for the suspended load, which is here in formulated in curvilinear coordinates. This is the settling velocity of the particles and so on. And very important, we have developed a sand slide algorithm to limit local bed slope and allow this process of where the bed stiffens and then you get local sandslides and so on. This is a process that happens continuously in nature, and we actually have this in the algorithm. Without this, you get completely unrealistic bed elevations, and again, all this is described in these papers. So, having given you an introduction of the numerical techniques, I would like now to move to the second part of my talk, which is really focusing on the work we have been doing on simulating sediment transport. And I will pick three specific examples of from our recent, very recent, and not so, I mean, a little bit recent, just a few years ago. So the first work is the work that was done by Christian Escauriaza for his PhD thesis, looking at transport of individual sand grains in front of the turbulent flow in a horseshoe vortex, and then looking at ripples inside the scour hole. And then we'll talk about ripples in a laboratory flume, and then I'll show you some of the results of dune propagation in big rivers with hydraulic structures and so on. So my first example then is essentially that of bridge scour, right? We have a cylindrical pier, flow is coming this way, begins to scour the bed, you get a big hole. Actually, this could collapse. This is a major mechanism for hydraulic infrastructure to collapse during flooding events. And the point I want to make here is not only we get a big scour hole, but you also, as you can see here, you get sand waves actually developing in this scour hole. So we wanted to study this problem, and we started actually. The first thing is before we can tackle the sediment transport, we wanted to understand the flow. Okay, and it turns out that the flow as the flow hits the bridge pier actually becomes quite complicated when the flow is turbulent. So there was some work that was done in the 90s by Davenport and Simpson, a classical work in the Journal of Fluid Mechanics, where they consider the case of an obstacle here. So this is a three-dimensional cylindrical wing right here. So this we're now looking at the symmetry plane, right? Right.
Can you just remind us in the picture before, which direction was the flow coming from?
I mean, the flow is coming this way.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, in this case. But so here now we have the cylinder is here, right? This is the cylinder, and the flow is coming this way. So you have a boundary layer encountering the cylinder. Well, we kind of know what happens, right? The flow will separate and roll up to form this horseshoe vortex that wraps around the structure, right? Well, what is interesting though is that, and that happens for very low Reynolds numbers. It happens at laminar flow where this horseshoe vortex is steady, and in laminar flow you get a series of multiple steady vortices as this vorticity interacts with the bed and creates vorticity of opposite sign and so on. But above a certain Reynolds number, this vortex system becomes unsteady. And when the flow is turbulent, actually, the dynamics is quite interesting, because in the experiment of Davenport and Simpson, they were actually showed that they found that, okay, you have this standard mode that you expect most of the time, or there were enough percentage of time in their experiment that the flow sort of hit the cylinder and created this vortex structure, which is a typical sort of vortex thing that we'll expect. But they also found another mode where this clear vortex path didn't happen. There was more of a disorganized flow with strong eruptions from the bed. Okay? And we did numerical simulations, and this has been actually published a number of years ago. This was some of the first simulation of this type of flow it was a hybrid LES RANS type of model called the detached eddy simulation. And you see here a visualization of the, using the Q isosurfaces, visualizing actually the vortical structure. So this is the cylinder right here. You see this big horseshoe vortex that is wrapping around the cylinder. This is the mode of a single necklace vortex that goes around the cylinder. But then we saw this clear instability of the cylinder, where actually we had in between the vortex and the wall, this hairpin secondary structures grew that surrounded the vortex and destroyed it. Okay, the vortex actually destroyed right here, giving rise to what they call the zero flow mode. And then, of course, what happens, the mean pressure gradient is still there, so the boundary layer will separate again, and the vortex will form again at roughly the correct position, where it depends on the pressure gradient and the boundary layer that's approaching. And this process sort of repeats in an aperiodic manner. And in fact, the experiment showed that there was a distinct bimodal velocity fluctuation PDFs, and this is what was reproduced from the simulation, showing two distinct peaks for the this is the velocity at one point right here, corresponding to the backflow and the zero flow mode. So this is the and you can see this actually here in this movie. Okay, this is really what happens. The flow is coming from this way. This big vortex forms. It goes unstable and it gets obliterated actually, and then senses the pressure gradient again. The boundary layer separates to reform this vortex, and then it is the interaction of the vortex with the bed that creates the secondary instabilities and so on. So this thing repeats, and that's really the characteristic of very high Reynolds number turbulent flows in bridge foundations, okay? So now we have this flow field, and then we could go to the next stage. Let's actually put particles there and begin to understand the transport events of what is going on. So the first test that we did, the first sort of numerical experiment, was to look at it from a Lagrangian point of view. And we had the flow field. The flow field is what I showed you before. We put particles on the bed. So you see we have a patch of particles right here. And we write the Lagrangian equation for the particles. We have actually a number of relevant terms that are incorporated in there, and the details are given in this JFM paper. Now, a couple of things here. There are a few assumptions here. The particles do not influence the flow, so this is a very dilute concentration of particles here. The particles do not interact with each other, but the particles are allowed to interact with the bed, and there are friction Coulomb type forces that are incorporated in the model to allow particles to slide on the bed and incorporate friction in there. Okay, so when we solve this, knowing this unsteady flow field, we solve the equations of these particles, and we wanted to see really what happens, what type of transport emerges when this happens. And you can see when we turn on the flow now, you can actually see the particles getting transported right here. And one of the things that it is actually quite, I mean, there are many, many interesting things you could see here, really. I can play this movie again for you. You can see this very episodic and intermittent type of transport. You see there are certain areas where you get this sudden burst of particles. You get particles to align on the bed and form streaks. These are streaks between vortices. These are consistent. This is consistent with what has been observed in experiments with particles in wall-bounded flows. We see particles saltating on the bed and sliding along the bed, which is the mode of bed load transport. Yes?
And can I ask, you showed these flow visualizations a bit earlier. Was that from looking from the same point of view, and can you correlate sort of these bursting events that you had there with the...
Yeah. Let me show you. So this is kind of, the orientation is different here. We look at the flow this way. This actually looks this way, but the vortex is right here. All this, that the complexity that you saw before, was all is located in this area. So the flow is coming from this way, and all the instabilities that I showed before is happening right where the particles are.
And do they correlate sort of with the more active particle transport?
So you see, I'll show you a couple of images here. So
the particles aren't interacting with one another.
The particles are interacting with one another. This is a dilute sort of environment. These are the assumptions. They do not interact with the flow. They do not interact with one another, but they do interact with the bed. So they can hit the bed. They can bounce back into the flow and so on. Okay. So this is an instantaneous snapshot showing particles colored with velocity magnitude. And what we found actually is that there is this about 40 degrees angle where you saw this here. This burst. This is a very high speed event here where particles sort of, all of them at that particular location seem to erupt from the bed. And sure enough, in experiments, they have seen that around this location is where actually bed load transport over sand beds begins to originate. I believe this has to do with the fact that as the vortex forms, it begins to stretch with the gradients around the structure there, and it intensifies enough to actually bring all this into suspension here. And you can see the streaks that are forming and so on. Now, to look at your question, if we take a slice through that plane, so looking at this plane right here, and you look here at vorticity, this is vorticity contours, you actually see here an event where actually a vertical structure right here is created off the bed and lifts off particles and entrains in the vortex core these particles that are taken off the bed. And so this process sort of repeats continuously. And so we have very complicated dynamics here. And the question is, how do we characterize this right now, this complexity, right? So in order to answer this question, we want to try to understand what do the simulation tell us in terms of the characteristics of transport as they arise from the simulations. Because we know quite a bit from experiments about how particles move in bed load. I should mention, by the way, that this whole experiment corresponds to a situation that if the cylinder is not there, nothing would move. Okay? This is called clear water scour. It is the presence of the cylinder that actually creates flow. It creates excess shear stress, essentially, that creates the motion. So we don't, without the cylinder, there would be no transport in this. Yes?
So the incoming flow is not turbulent?
The incoming flow is turbulent. But the mean shear stress is below the threshold of, it's right at the threshold of motion.
I see.
Okay? So that's called the clear water condition. If without the cylinder, nothing happens. The bed stays stable. If you keep increasing the flow rate, and then ultimately it will come alive. But we just looked at this. This is the condition we considered here. So we take a plane right here at the back, and now we can count how many particles are crossing that plane with time. Okay, that's a way to determine the bed load flux. All right, and when we do this, we actually get some very interesting patterns. So this is time, and this is the number of particles that are crossing this window, and what you see here, you get this sort of hiatus-dominated transport process, where you have this kind of plateaus where nothing seems to happen, and then an event happening and so on. And of course, what is quite spectacular is as you zoom in there, you begin to see sort of self-similarity down to the resolution of this. So as you zoom all the way in here, the more you zoom, the more steps of arbitrary duration you find, and mass transport events where particles come into motion. Again, there is a range of self-similar scales here, and this particular structure that we see here is actually a well-known structure, a well-known fractal entity. It's called the Devil's Staircase, and it has been observed actually in a number of dynamical systems undergoing mode locking transition to chaos. We have also found this type of staircase in chaotically advected flows inside the vortex breakdown bubbles. We have found it in laminar flows, which are also chaotically advected, where particles are settling from suspension into the bed. So we've done quite a bit of work in fluid systems where actually this type of behavior emerges. But it appears in this case. And here we're computing, just to prove that this is indeed, this is power scaling, we are computing the fractal dimension of essentially the Cantor set associated with this staircase. And as you increase the number of particles, you approach this fractal dimensional convergence to this point at 8.7 scale here, which is really, it's kind of the universal fractal dimension for dissipative dynamical systems. This is a dissipative dynamical system here because the particle velocity field does not satisfy continuity equation. You have all these other forces, right? Yeah.
If you're simulating this with the Rance model?
This is an LES model with Rance boundary conditions at the wall. It's a hybrid, but this is, yeah.
LES.
Yeah.
So the way you described it earlier was that your particles were at the threshold of sort of being moved, and therefore you would pick up the low intensity events would not do anything, and the big intensity events would do something. So this should be correlated in that sense then to sort of the turbulent cascade.
Right.
And it should truncate at the level of the resolution.
Because
actually, normally it would sort of continue further on down to the dissipated phase.
Right. The simulation, the model that we have here, it's such that it only resolves the larger energetic scales of motion here, right? This is a hybrid Rance LES type of model.
Okay.
right? So there is a cutoff for the scales that we can resolve. But what I'm showing here is what happens to the particles when they are transported by this resolved flow field. Okay? And that's the Lagrangian advection exhibits these features, actually, that has this power law scaling behavior, right?
How fine is your grid relative to the particles?
So that's a very good question. So this is a very fine mesh simulation, actually. There are about 10 grid planes per particle diameter near the bed. So we actually deliberately use the very, very fine mesh. We go deep into Y plus of less than 0.1, actually, in this case, to resolve the near wall flow and make sure, because we want to calculate, we want to make sure that these forces, that the forces that are calculated there depend on gradients, right, of the flow quantity. So we want to make sure that we have at least 10 grid nodes resolving each particle in there.
But you're using a point force particle, so it doesn't matter relative to the actual size.
Yeah,
because
but
the gradients.
Right.
But you, in doing that, you ignore rolling, for example, as a mode of particle motion.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you worried about that?
No, we could incorporate it. I mean, it might be something that you want to incorporate. But here, we'd only have the linear velocities that we're solving with, right?
Yeah.
We have the
linear
velocity.
You have frictional resistance.
You have frictional resistance, and the beds are actually saltating. I mean, the particles are saltating on the bed. They are actually doing this hopping from one location to the other, and they can slide against the bed. So.
Do you understand correctly? The particles do not interact with each other when they are
particles
impinging on the bed.
When they impinge, they interact with the bed, but they do not interact with each other.
So you have something like a splash function?
We actually bounce the particle back in a sort of an inelastic collision type, and we have a Coulomb friction force to allow for sliding against the bed in there.
But no new particles are ejected.
No new particles are ejected. This is just a fixed population of particles. This was not intended to be a model of bridge cower, okay, of what happens. It was intended to give us fundamental understanding of how this complex horseshoe vortex actually interact with particles. And we're very surprised to find a number of things, including these types of behavior, and what I'll show you here now. One characteristic here is that we have transport event with no characteristic time scale, right? Because all these horizontal plateaus actually have a range of values involved, right? So there's no characteristic time scale. And for each characteristic time, for each time scale, if you pick your time scale, if you pick your window at which you examine this time series, you see a range of transport events. Okay, so this is it has been observed before experimentally that bed load transport exhibits multifractal scaling. So we to quantify this, we characterize now, we are focusing on the vertical axis where we're looking at the size of mass transfer events. So this is the number, so we pick our scale R, and we count the particles at T plus R minus T, and this is, we are interested really at the steps, so at the points where this function is not differentiable, and we quantify this through the singularity strength alpha. And in this case, we have, for a given R, we have a range of transport events, and we have a range of alphas. And essentially, the number of these singularity exponents is assumed to scale exponentially, where this would be the fractal dimension of the set of these singularity strengths. And if this is a multifractal process, we would have a continuous distribution of fractal dimension. And we have shown here the results of this, actually, when we calculate the multifractal spectrum alpha as a function and this exponent right here, as we increase the number of particles, we approach, actually, you can fill in more and more of this. Of course, in order to fill in all the tails, you need to have infinitely many particles and to make your time step very small enough. But we actually do get a multifractal type of transport mode here out of this very simple model. So we see a lot of the complex dynamics that are known about bed load transport we're able to reproduce through this model that actually incorporates a lot of the unsteadiness and complexity of the horseshoe vortex that drives the particle motion. So what is interesting is this hiatus-dominated process, which occurs there locally in front of a bridge pier, is also what occurs at big geophysical timescales, right? It is known, actually, this is a classical paper by Sattler now, at any given level of resolution, the sedimentary stratigraphic record may be regarded as a stack of sediment increments separated by surface of hiatus. So it's quite striking now that you see exactly the same thing occurring in a very small, simple system. And so obviously there is something here that permeates in the whole system across a range of scales, okay? Now, the next piece right now, of course, I mentioned before, this is not really something that we can calculate. We can see the erosion and we can see bed forms. You could, but you have to put millions of particles, right? You could do this, but you have to put a lot of particles. And this is not really a practical engineering simulation tool if you really want to simulate bed forms. So my student, Christian, actually took these ideas to try to develop an Eulerian model of bed load transport. And then now we have to solve the Exner equation near the bed. And we need to calculate this bed load flux, which depends on something, some quantity here, which is the aerial concentration and the average particle velocity parallel to the bed. I should say that for the most part, approaches in the past have assumed that this particle velocity is really extrapolated from the flow velocity. Okay, and this gamma is really depending on Van Rijn type of calculations or empirical relations that relate this quantity to the shear stress and the critical shear stress and so on. So what we did, our contribution there was not only to develop a model, an Eulerian model that will allow us to see how the bed deforms, but to also come up with a new way for calculating this. And the idea was the following. If we put these particles and we solve the Lagrangian equation in there, and we can see very complex behaviors. So what if we take this Lagrangian equation, we map it into an Eulerian frame of reference on the bed, and we use it to derive the velocity of these particles by solving a transport equation that incorporates all the instantaneous forces that we have in the Lagrangian model. So that's kind of the idea of the model. We use an arbitrary Lagrangian Eulerian approach where the bed actually follows the bed, the grid follows the bed and deforms with it here. This is different than the immersed boundary method I spoke before, and I'll explain the limitations of this method in a minute. We solve the Exner equation right here, and we develop this new equation for quantifying, for calculating the velocity of sediment particles. We have the Lagrangian model, and then we actually map this equation into an Eulerian model, into a transport equation in generalized curvilinear coordinates for the velocity of the sediment grains, driven with all the same forces that we put in the Lagrangian model. Now, this is a very nice approach because through this term, you can, you know, one issue is how does one incorporate turbulent fluctuations into the motion of particles near the bed? Well, this is done readily in this model because we have this force, okay? We calculate all the forces I showed you before. So when we do this, and you let it run, this is what happens. You start with a flat bed, and you begin to see actually the bed begins to erode, but then you begin to see very complicated and very realistic bed forms, okay? You see these continuous sediment waves right here. You see they propagate around the cylinder. They merge with each other. They grow in size and so on. Very realistically looking behavior. So to try to quantify this with some experimental data, this corresponded to an experiment that was done by Dargahi a number of years ago, and we tried to set it up. There was some anecdotal evidence of what happened in this flow. So Dargahi described in his experiment that after 5 seconds, scouring at the sides of the cylinder starts. And sure enough, we also found that in our simulation, the bed was destabilized roughly at 5 seconds when the simulation started, okay? And we did an XT diagram and so on, and we showed actually that the velocity, the migration velocity of this bed forms is about 0.1 meters per second. So the results are actually correct in that regard. Yeah?
Do you want to say something about the particle-particle forces? Or?
So in this model, it's a macroscopic model, right? We model the whole bed load layer as a single layer, and we just solve this Exner equation that tells me how the height of this layer changes in response to the turbulent forcing.
But you said that the velocity of these particles right in the layer is induced by the Lagrangian model that includes forces. And
right.
I'm just curious about the nature of the forces.
So the forces are exactly the same forces that I showed before in the Lagrangian model. Let's see, I have them here.
Right, so here, the single layer of particles interacting with a bed, right?
So in this,
not interacting with one another.
In this model, yeah, but in this model that I showed, the new model does not have particles in it. All it has is now I'm saying, okay, let me assume that the bed is covered with this layer of particles, and I can calculate the force that is acting on these particles in a continuous manner as it is distributed on that surface. And how am I calculating it? by using as a force essentially the same, all the forces that are acting in the individual Lagrangian particles when we did the simulation.
Yeah, same fluid forces, but
same fluid.
But then is this equivalent then to a sheet moving frictionally on a bed? I mean, in terms of the particle bed interactions.
I do not think so.
Okay.
I do not think so. That, yeah.
And so when particles get eroded, you track them as bed load transfer, and then they can sediment again.
So in this model, there is no suspended load. The assumption is that we have transport in the range of in bed load transport, which means that particles move within a layer of thickness H, and they can tumble around the bed, but they don't get out of this. So this is a macroscopic equation that gives you the particle velocity within this cloud of particles that are moving very close to the bed. That only simulates the mode of transport, which is bed load transport, which means nothing comes into suspension. There's no suspended transport equation here that keeps track of anything that.
In the equation that you listed there previously, there's the history force terms and the acceleration, which if you're just, it sort of depends on where the particle was and where it's going, and it can come from multiplicity of directions.
So we have tried to simplify and keep only the main forces of lift and drag and so on. But the important thing right now, because I'll show you a new model right now, which now the problem with this model, the limitation that requires very fine grid near the bed, because you have to have these forces to be realistic. You have to have a lot of resolution to be able to calculate the gradients correctly. And it is also a model where the grid actually follows the bed. So if you're talking about arbitrarily large waveforms sand waves in rivers, this is not a good model, okay? So I'll explain in a minute how we have handled this. But let me tell you a little bit about these bed forms, because it turns out that we also wanted, in addition to getting some anecdotal information that they are reasonable based on what has been observed visually in experiments, we wanted to look at their statistical properties. And there's quite a bit of work that has shown how these types of bed forms behave in nature. So imagine now you take a line here, and you have an instantaneous distribution as a function of S of bed elevation, right? And so we could try to look at the RMS for a given scale delta S. I pick a particular scale delta S, I sample that elevation series there, and I compute the RMS based on an average, but at this scale, okay? And again, it has been shown that for self-similar transport and there has to be scaling here, there has to be exponential scaling, and one can define, plot the RMS multiplied by square root of delta S, and this would be the roughness exponent, as has been defined to quantify the roughness and the scaling of the surface. So we would expect that from our data we should be able to see this behavior, and sure enough, when we do this, we plot the RMS here as a function of delta S, we find a very nice scaling regime with a scale of 0.5 here, with an exponent of 0.5. And what you see here is also there is a point where we have this sustained about the two orders of magnitude, and then there's a saturation range. But this is actually, it's actually expected. This is the range of the largest triple wavelengths in our domain. So the bed forms can grow up to the largest possible, which in this case is about 0.3D, okay? So this is very much consistent with what has been observed in bed forms in nature. Another characteristic is the bed elevation spectra, which from experiments we know that there is an a minus 2 sort of dependence, and we have here the spectra, and we see we do have this slope for an order of magnitude. Now what happens here is because the equation that we use to solve the excess equation has dissipative terms that actually truncates the higher order fluctuation here. We don't have a subgrid scale model for bed elevation in the model. That's actually something that could be important for future work. But clearly we see that for as long as this is resolving the fluctuations, we are actually get this the correct slope.
You're focusing on the statistics, but what if we talk just about the shape of the ripple? Because from the back we couldn't really see that.
Yeah, so let me show you the next
dark crest with a slip face in the boundary.
Let me show you, I'll address this in the next thing now. Because the problem with this is we didn't have a lot of experimental data. In this case, there were very little data, and also this technique computation is extremely expensive. We could, to simulate few seconds, we have to run this code. So this was our old code. We couldn't go, we had to take months of computational time to get these results, okay? So going into rivers was out of the question, right? So now we have this newer techniques that I mentioned before, and I'll show you based on immersed boundary methods with very powerful iterative solvers and so on. This code actually served its role. This is what it produced, but now we couldn't go further and we had to make the significant investment in the numerical infrastructure. So your question will be addressed in a moment right now. And that brings me here. So now these are the more recent calculations. We haven't published those. The first time actually I'm showing these results here. Applying this Kervilina immersed boundary method that allows us to do arbitrarily complex bed shapes and what have you. We have wall models. We do not resolve in great detail the flow near the wall, but we have wall models. So let me show you the predictive capabilities of the method for this small-scale laboratory flume experiment. This is an experiment done by Venditti et al. It was published in JGR in 2005. It's basically a straight flume right here, non-cohesive homogeneous sand particles. We have a Reynolds number of 76,000, and you get bed forms that are of the scale 5 centimeters and wavelengths of 10 centimeters. So this is the experiment. Okay, you turn on the flow, you get these bed forms that initially are two-dimensional. Venditti, in a number of papers, they looked at in great detail, actually, at how this emerged initially and how they evolve into the stage that I showed you before. So they describe a process where the flow is turned on, actually, as the flow reaches the flow rate that actually the bed begins to move. You initially, spontaneously, you have these crosshatch patterns appear throughout the bed that shortly thereafter, they emerge this chevron, this inverted V type of shape patterns, which a little later organize to form these incipient crest lines, okay? And then as time goes by, you go into a two-dimensional state, which then are disorganized and disrupted into the emergence of this full three-dimensional state with these very complicated connections between different bed forms and so on. So here is, we set up a calculation. The grid is 43 million grid nodes. We have a pre-computed LES of a fully developed channel flow and a rigid bed that we are feeding at the inlet of this. We recirculate sediment as was done in the experiment. Now here we have both bed load and suspended sediment. It's a fully coupled calculation, right? And this is what happens when we turn on the flow. So this is the laboratory flume, our computational flume, let's say. Okay, you see the bed forms appearing, these complicated shapes emerging, and I want to bring your attention to these types of shapes that show up here. Very complicated connections, very similar to what has been observed actually in the experiment. Looking at the calculations in a little more detail, if we look at very early on, we see very similar patterns. We see these chevron shapes that begin to appear. So there are the sediment nodes that appear randomly on the bed, and then they form this kind of V-type of patterns. And as time goes by, these patterns organize into this incipient crest lines, so the beginning of the crest lines of the bed forms, okay? And sort of you see in this whole process. So the process appears to be very similar with what has been observed experimentally. The two-dimensional state in the experiment, is in the simulation, is not as clear as in the experiment, and I think this has to do with the initial conditions, because in the experiment, they crank up the flow slowly. We don't. We have a fully turbulent flow that's coming in, so we are getting a quasi-two-dimensional state, but then we're getting the three-dimensional state that is characterized by these complicated shapes here. And this is actually a very interesting feature showing how two bed forms merge. You have this excess amount of sediment here propagating and merging with a crest line that is further downstream and so on.
Is it true that in the numerical simulation, it's a fixed amount of sediment that is moving?
And it's been recirculating constantly, as they did in the experiment.
Yeah.
Okay, they recirculate the downstream sediment.
Well, so in the experiment, sediment can be incorporated from the bed.
Well, but in this case also, we have the case actually, the model allows for sediment to be picked up from the bed in this case. So we recirculate, we feed sediment at the inlet, which is recirculated from the exit, as they did in the experiment. And we also have the ability, because it's a fully coupled suspended bed load transport mode here, so sediment could be picked up and be deposited. These terms are there in the equations right now.
And how do you model that? How do you model erosion and deposition?
So this has all been modeled using empirical relations, so Van Rijn's classical formulations and so on. And that's, again, as I said, it's a limitation, but you see, you are able, and again, assuming that these time average correlations are actually correspond well with, can be used in an instantaneous flow setting. So we are using for the instantaneous pickup and deposition of sediment relations that are based from time average measurements. That's But I think this is really an area, I mean, since we're talking about grand challenge questions here, how does one go to the next stage and taking experimental all this new understanding of turbulence interacting with particles and develop models that can go? Because now we have the computational tool to test those. So some quantitative measurements. This is the data in terms of the amplitude, wavelength, and celerity. The points are the experimental data, and you see the average sort of amplitude, wavelength, and celerity. The results actually are pretty reasonable. Another interesting feature in the experiment was the Venditti. They tried to quantify the onset of three-dimensionality, and they did this by considering this non-dimensional span Weiss length. So take 2 points. This is the straight line. And then you can also measure it along the bed form that connects these 2 points, right? So if it is a two-dimensional form, this ratio is 1. The more three-dimensional it becomes, the greater than 1 it becomes, okay? So when you have shapes like this and what have you. So this is now time with this non-dimensional span-wise length. Blue is the experiment, red is the simulation. In the experiment, they define the onset of three-dimensionality as 1.2. You see, actually, the results are quite good given what we're comparing here. So we are not only getting things that look like bed forms, they seem to have actually a lot of the quantitative features that they observed in the experiment. This is the average over each instant in time. I mean, the others were all the points at every instant in time and so on. But we get things that look reasonable, they look realistic, and I am not going to get into that here because I don't have time, but there is also, we have done a spectral analysis of the bed forms, we look at the statistical scaling, they're very similar to what I showed for the previous case, okay? The only thing here is now this is a method that can, it's much more powerful, you can do things in real complex settings. So the nice thing now, having this capability, is that we can see how the flow interacts with these bed forms. Okay, so this is a video of instantaneous velocity magnitude contours, starting from flat bed. So you see the bed forms forming. You see the crest lines becoming steep, then eroding, propagating downstream. And one thing that you notice here is actually all these low speed streaks, actually events, bursting events that are bringing low speed fluid. They are strong enough to reach all the way to the surface, okay? And this is the same, it's the continuation of the previous video. It's a very long video, and it's interesting because you can see there are instances, actually, where you have eruptions from the bed hitting the surface, okay? And of course, now there are interesting things. Now, can by one monitor the time series of velocity at the surface say something about the bed forms, right? And what, so that's, these are some of the things that we're trying to figure out right now and explore having this type of results.
But they look very steep.
Yeah.
I thought you had some
collapse. There is. You see, they steepen and then they fall. There is a collapse. So they steepen up to the angle of repose, and then there is this this model that actually redistributes sediment around and so on.
This is not a stretch scale. This is.
This scale, by the way, is stretch here. I'm sorry. This is stretch scale in order to be able to see this. Yeah, they are. Yeah, I apologize for that. That's why they look steeper than usual. Their sizes are actually, you saw the comparisons before.
I also noticed that they are concave upwards towards their crest. And if I look at ripples, normally I can see a little convexity towards the crest.
Well, that's something that we need to look into a little more. I mean, we had this experimental data set as guidance, and of course, they don't have these types of data. If we had somehow in the experiment to be able to see the profiles more clearly, but that's something that I would have to look into that.
What is the second?
So the second is actually concentration of suspended sediment.
In the laboratory?
No, that's in the simulation. Yeah. So this really shows you how the ripples actually create these eruptions of suspended sediments and so on. But that's something that we need to look into that. That's a good point. So that's actually another interesting thing, looking at coherent structure dynamics now. So you initially get the span-wise crest lines that create these rollers, but as they begin to become three-dimensional and so on, you get these distinct hairpin shapes that are set from this. So that's where we are with this, and we have, I mean, we are still, this is very much work in progress, but we seem to see some things that suggest that these things are realistic. I mean, there may be issues that we need to look further, but nevertheless, we begin to see some bed forms that resemble what has been observed experimentally. And I'll show you quickly a couple of other simulations. I know I'm almost out of time, so I'll run through this quickly. The idea is to show you here the ability now to simulate in a bigger system and having hydraulic structures in here, set of rock veins and what have you. And I'll just play these different movies here just as an illustration of these are bed elevation contours in a meandering channel with these types of hydraulic structures. And we can see this dune type of structures emerging downstream. And for different types of, so the ability to simulate complicated structures and in more realistic settings. There are experiments that have been done in the outdoor stream lab. This is a space diagram from the calculation showing how this actually begin to propagate fast, and they slow down as they emerge, consistent with what's been observed. We were able to actually place those in Van Rijn's non-dimensional diagrams, and the characteristics actually are within the range of dunes. And there are these are a combination of all the experiments, celerity, amplitude, and wavelength. This is collectively what we find. All the values are within the range of what has been observed experimentally. And the last thing I want to show you from this is actually now going into bigger scale. So we went from the laboratory scale, we went into a small stream scale. Now, how can we predict how well we do here in terms of predicting things in large rivers? So this is a meandering river which is designed actually to have meandering characteristics that resemble what is found in nature for gravels and sand type of streams or rivers. The particular case I'll show you, the river is 27 meters, the flow depth is about 1 meter, and the Reynolds number is 1.3 million. This is a calculation now that was done with Rand's model, because at this scale, really, the LES, it's not really feasible, okay? But the good news is that the unsteady Rand's model, which fails completely in the small scale, actually, to produce this, to get these ripples going, at this scale, actually, these bed forms appear naturally with Urans. And I'll show you the result of the simulation. So you see here as we turn the flow through the meander bend, and you see bed elevation contours. So you see regions of deposition near the inner bed and scour along the outer bed. I'm going to bring this a little closer because that's actually an interesting pattern that emerges here. And so you can see these distinct patterns of deposition that are observed here. And this is actually seems to be very similar to what they observed in large rivers in nature. Okay, these types of features in the inner bed is more or less what we are seeing here. Okay, so again, for these types of, we don't have data for this. What we have is sort of looking at what it looks like in rivers, and also by calculating the characteristics of these bed forms and putting them in this available, you know, Van Rijn's classification diagrams, and seeing that they are indeed they are big dune type of forms here. So anyway. I have, probably I'm out of time, right? So maybe I should stop here. Maybe we can take a couple more minutes. I'll show you the last part. I just have, I think, two or three slides left. Talk a little bit about this energy sediment nexus here. So now we're talking about putting hydrokinetic turbines in rivers and extracting energy. So that's a big thing, actually, in the US right now. There's a lot of focus in this area. But of course, now we have to worry about turbines interacting with sediment beds, okay? And the interaction could be dual, because you can. The question is, how do devices like that impact the morphodynamic regime of a particular river system? But also, what happens when big dunes are passing through this, interacting with the turbines? The bed is changing, right? The roughness is changing. These are large-scale features, how the power performance of these devices is affected, okay? There is a wealth of questions that could be explored. So I'll just show you an experiment that was done recently at SAFL by Michele Guala, my colleague, and Craig Hill, one of our students there, where we placed a model turbine right here in the main channel. This is a mobile bed, so the flow is coming from this way here. We have a laser scanner that scans the bed, when the turbine begins, so this is bed elevation, showing actually what the turbine does to this flow. I should say that if there is, this is a clear water condition, so if there is nothing in the channel at this condition, no sediment moves. If you put just the pylon, just the vertical pylon of this turbine, the cylinder, you get only local scour near the cylinder, all right? If you put the rotor, the complete turbine, but without rotation, you'd only get the local scour around the cylinder. The moment the turbine begins to rotate, actually, this is what happens. And the reason that this happens is that the flow accelerates to go around the turbine, all right? Well, it goes through and its energy is extracted, but you get an area of high shear stress between the lower tip of the turbine and the bed that actually brings the bed alive. And then you get these very interesting patterns propagating here. You get this depositional bar that propagates the scour zone, and you see this very distinct sort of crest line that is related to the presence of the this pylon, actually, in the horseshoe vortex system. So I just briefly, we have just started computationally to explore these problems, and I'll show you just a video of our recent results. So this is the simulation now. We have the turbine rotating, interacting with a mobile bed, and you can see this sort of deposition zone that forms here, this V-shape pointing forward as in the experiment, and the scour here forming. This is the instantaneous velocity fields at one plane here. There is quite some interesting things to observe here. So the flow is coming, it's coming from the left, and you can see the bed rising here, right? So one thing that you can see the reason why sediment begins here is this high velocity region that occurs here. But what is quite interesting for energy production is as the bed steepens, as this zone begins to build up, it sort of causes the flow to separate and begins to interact with the outer shear layer, causing very fast mixing. And the wake, actually, in this case, when the bed is moving, is much shorter than when the bed is flat. The shorter the wake, the less the losses, the more energy production capability actually that you have. So, and in fact, when you have the turbine downstream, it could have, under the right conditions, favorable implications. So this is just one of the first comparisons that we recently did with the experiment. So this is the LES, and these are the measured instantaneous bed elevation contours. One area that we are missing is this very deep scour zone right downstream of the depositional bar. We have not been able, this is actually below, this is, it's steeper than the angle of repose, and I suspect that it is may have to do with the fact that the experiment had some cohesive material in the sediment bed, which we cannot incorporate. But that's something that puzzles us, actually. But everything else seems to be reasonable, at least. So anyway, so with this, I just conclude with a couple of thoughts that hopefully I showed you that we have now the ability to simulate hydromorphodynamic problems in real-life waterways, and we have been able to demonstrate, actually, that we are able to, these computational models that are based largely on decades-old empirical relations that have been calibrated using time-average flow fields perform reasonably well, okay, for when they are coupled with an LES. But clearly, I think the key challenge for the future is really to advance parameterizations for LES models, and two types of parameterizations, I would say. One is really to look at this pickup relations of sediment based on the instantaneous flow conditions, and also subgrid scale models for the bed fluctuations itself, actually. And I think there is a lot of new understanding from state-of-the-art experiments on particle turbulence interactions, and the challenge, I think, as a community is now how this type of new understanding can be incorporated. I mean, experiments are still needed because there is insight that needs to be prescribed in the LES model right at the bed. I mean, we cannot model every particle if we want to go to simulate large rivers like this. So with this, I would like to end my talk, and thank you for your attention.
How would you characterize the rheology of the bed load?
Probably non-Newtonian, I would say. I mean, it would be, it's a mixture, it's a slurry, right? It's a mixture of...
But I mean, in the code, it seems as if there isn't much interaction between the elements of the...
That is correct. So what we are actually, we are solving an equation for just the interface, okay? And whatever interactions are incorporated in this Exner equation, okay, that tells you the bed load flux. So, but there is no details, there is no, in this model, there is no detailed interaction of what happens inside that layer.
It seems like it's almost a perfect fluid. It is influenced both at its top and at bottom by
sure.
The boundary conditions.
And that's where actually you want to have some physical understanding through the boundary conditions. This is the missing link, that you, if you could resolve all these details, you wouldn't need to have these approximate empirical boundary conditions. But you're right, it is a perfect fluid that is interacting with the bed through boundary conditions that are prescribed from these empirical relations. So with these physical limitations, so you have to look at these results with this in mind.
Right? It's probably a very naive question, but I'm ignorant of what has been done for rivers there. I have noticed that in rivers you have sometimes less inclined air, regions, and then there is a rapid and then they come to a less inclined region and so on. Is that something that you could find in your bed load transport simulation, or is this something that's already known in the field, or how is that?
So you're talking about reflux zones? I mean,
well, just, you know, rivers, natural rivers often have.
Well, there is.
Fast flowing rivers with some small gravity. Yeah.
So one thing that you also, one other limitation that I didn't mention is this model assumes a single particle size so far, right? And a lot of these, so in rivers, when you get reflux zones, you have bigger particles that sort of stay in place, and you have more sandy beds downstream and so on. So the model as is right now cannot do this, but I don't see any reason why, if in a sandbed system, there are situations like that that would arise, that this cannot be predicted by this model. At least everything we've done so far suggests that for the things we've looked, we get reasonable results. Mm-hmm. But we are just scratching the surface right now.
Okay.
There is more long ways to go into modeling this complexity of sediment transport in real systems, precisely because you have this range of particles that often interact with each other.
So polydispersity could be a major issue for many of those.
Yeah.
In your model results with the ripple field that evolves, you highlighted the first shoe vertices that were coming out. Have you queried closer in the bed to see how the fluid is really being deflected by the bed forms and how it's affecting the bed form growth itself?
We have done this more in the more recent simulation that I showed you in these videos right now. So we are trying to analyze this right now, actually, in more detail, because we have, but we haven't looked at it yet in detail. But this is one of the things that we are planning to do right now, to really look at how exactly, address this question, how exactly the flow, how the coupling occurs really at the bed. And you can see, actually, that as these features on the bed steepen, you get shear layers locally that happen, that set off the crest lines, actually, and you get very intense vorticity shedding that helps to erode the crest lines and advances the propagation further downstream. But I think there is a lot more rich information that can be, a lot more information that can be extracted out of this data. Yeah. So there is.
Yes, I would like to come back on the membrane force. First, to comment. In my opinion, I think that the memory force is often not taken into account because of this computational nightmare.
Yep.
And then there are the arguments why it maybe is not such an important force. Nowadays, there are computational efficient methods available to do it on a similar process as the other terms in the Vector-Riley equation. Then, related with that, there are studies on the relevance of the different contributions in Maxi-Riley for particle transport, where you have density ratios as in your application. There you see that on the particle level, the Bessel force is an important force. It is, for heavy particles, you can ignore it, but for sediment-like particles, it is one of the top three forces that should be included. But on the other hand, when you consider not particle level, but the ensemble of particles, you see that it, its effect on average is not so important. And that brings me to the following question. You have included major forces. Did you try to carry out kind of sensitivity analysis?
No, that's a very good question. No, we didn't. Our main concern when we did this first study was to try to come up with a model that it is sophisticated yet tractable enough. So we try to include, but we didn't. We haven't done what you're asking. I think that's an excellent question. It's something
but
that.
But also by removing some of the
Sure. Yeah. But that's something that would be a very interesting study. I agree. Yeah.
The simulations you showed at the beginning of your talk, and the detail you showed there is really overwhelming. And my question is, how much coarser can you do the simulations and still get the essential information? It seems to me virtually impossible to actually make use of this wealth of detail that you have in the simulation. So where is the, how far do you have to go in order to get it right? And how coarse can you go and still?
Yeah, so that's actually a very interesting question, because obviously, okay, we have the capacity to do the simulation. Now the question is, how do you go into how complex do you make the model, right? Of course, the reason that the key reason that we have this capacity is because of high performance computing right now. And these simulations wouldn't have been unthinkable just 5 years from now, this level of simulation. It was, in fact, our earlier codes, it would take a year to complete the simulation of the river that I showed you, literally a year. We'd calculate something that now we could do in a matter of a few weeks. So that's one thing to keep in mind, that we are in a future of exponentially growing computing. And if this is possible now, I think in a few years from now, this is going to be something that you can do on your desktop, or a system that is cheap enough that will be on your desktop, you know. But your question is a very good one. And to some extent, we have looked at it using this meandering river case, because doing the simulation is very refined LES. We found a very complicated system of secondary flows in there. It is vortices, these helical vortices that develop in the meander bed. And we actually try to see, to pose the question now, can we predict similar things with a cruder model, like a Reynolds average type of model, which is just a fraction of this calculation or computational cost. And it turns out that if the meander is curved enough, you can't. So you can run a cheaper calculation, but you cannot get the patterns and the intensity of the secondary currents that you get out of this complex simulation. And the reason for this is that these types of phenomena, secondary flows in bends, depend on the pressure gradients, but also depends on the anisotropy of turbulence in there. And this type of branch models, which are a lot cheaper, they cannot readily account for that anisotropy. And for certain types of problems, you just have to bite the bullet and do this. Okay. Now, the other thing is, if you're interested in looking at the transport of, nutrients in this, okay, and residence times, you saw the simulation where actually how traces were trapped in areas. It's impossible to capture those with. I mean, you could parameterize them somehow and get this, but I think these are flows that are dominated by coherent structures that are induced by the geometry of the river. Okay. And you would ask a cruder turbulence model, like a Ranz model, to account for all this in a single eddy viscosity, right? So there is a level of complexity of your geometry of your system that I think beyond which it makes it really difficult to, and it would be unreasonable for a simpler model to parameterize all this in one eddy viscosity coefficient, okay? All these turbulence. So it's a difficult thing, and it is something that has to be, the bed forms, for instance, with a simpler model, you cannot get them unless you have this LES, at least in the smaller scale. Unless you have this very fine LES, actually, you cannot get it. So it's a question that it's an excellent one, but one that requires to be answered in context of the specific system that you are interested in considering, actually, specific case you want to simulate.
A double staircase structure of the intermittent transport that you showed. If that's truly universal, then it suggests there's a simpler, or much simpler, one-dimensional model that could be extracted. Do you have any clues as how to extract a one-dimensional transport model from your?
From this calculation, no, I don't. But you're right. I mean, there's obviously some underlying dynamics in there. That if you see this type of behavior in this complicated model looking at individual grains, and then you see it in you see evidence of this in the long time scale stratigraphic record, that you have this type of hiatus transport. I think there is work that is done right now with fractional derivative modeling and so on that are trying to account for these types of effects in a much simpler way. But so you, from this model, though, you can get some information about overall transport, but then it depends on what you're looking for, right? If you're looking for in a river whether your stream bank is going to erode, and by how much, that model is not likely. I mean, it will give you an idea about the overall transport sediment, but and maybe you are able to say something, but it depends, again, on the question that you have. But we haven't done any work in this area.
Any more questions?
Thanks very much.